the House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, what is the latest estimate for the total cost of the health system restructure, and what risks, if any, have been identified that could delay the new system being established by July next year?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Tolofalava, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in response to the first part of the member's question, Budget 2021 provided a total of $485 million over the next 4 years, which includes funding to establish the Māori Health Authority, establish Health NZ, build workforce capacity, prototype localities, and support the Transition Unit and Ministry of Health through the transition. In response to the second part of the member's question, as would be expected for a reform of this scale, there are material risks that need to be monitored and managed as we move towards implementation. These include disruption and uncertainty of the system and for those working within it. However, I'm confident that these risks are being managed and mitigated appropriately.
Supplementary. If there is a business case for the health restructuring, what does the business case estimate the total cost of the health restructuring will be?
Mr. Speaker, I thought I'd largely answered that question in my answer to his primary question. But to the extent that the member asked for a business case, the case for change was made in the report of the Health and Disability System Review that was published last year. And it's not only made there, but it's made in the literally hundreds and thousands of people I come across pretty much every day who tell me it's time for change in our health system and to have a health system that serves the needs of all New Zealanders.
Supplementary. When he was unable to name one health outcome yesterday that would be improved in the first year of the $485 million health restructuring, can he today name one health outcome that will be improved in the first year of the restructuring?
Mr. Speaker, we will have a better health system as a result of these reforms.
Supplementary. Is he really telling New Zealanders that for $485 million in health restructuring, he cannot today name one single health outcome that will be improved in the first year?
Mr. Speaker, I can revert to the answer I gave in question at Select Committee yesterday and say that that member has been just a little bit cute. So, for a party when in government, successively underfunded the health system year after year after year and has left it to this government to rebuild it and restore it and restore public confidence in it, I'm just a little bit stunned that he is looking for those sorts of responses. The reality is we have a health system now that is not serving the needs of all New Zealanders and it needs to change, and we are changing it.
Supplementary. How will spending $485 million in creating new health agencies in Wellington make any difference to the outlook for a Māori patient in South Auckland on renal dialysis?
Mr. Speaker, the member clearly misunderstands what has been provided for in the budget 2 weeks ago. Maybe he hasn't read it, but actually what that funding will provide for, just in relation to the Māori Health Authority, is not just establishing that Māori Health Authority, but actually working on some initial commissioning of Māori services and building the capability of Kaupapa Māori Health Services. In addition to that, it is providing for the establishment of Health New Zealand. Health New Zealand actually needs to be across Māori health needs as well, because it's not going to be confined to just one single part of the health system. There are a number of things that that investment is going to purchase, but in the end, it will be about a well and much improved health system for all New Zealand.
Supplementary. How many extra years of life, if any, is it estimated that New Zealanders will gain from $485 million spent on health restructuring compared to $485 million invested in Pharmac?
Mr. Speaker, what will improve life chances and life expectations for New Zealanders is actually having a health system for the long term, the long sustainable term, that provides the health needs for all New Zealanders. That's why this government has increased its funding for the health system by more than 45% since it became government, has put more than $5 billion into health facilities since it's become government. That's the stuff that over time adds to life chances.
Question number two, Barbara Edmonds.
To the Minister of Finance, what recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker, the government's ongoing support to secure the economic recovery is being reflected in the Crown's financial accounts. The Crown accounts for the 10 months to the end of April 2021 were released today, and they show that both the operating balance before gains and losses, the OBGAL, and the overall operating balance are better than forecast in the budget in May. The OBGAL was a deficit of $5 billion, $3.6 billion better than forecast in the budget. Tax revenue was $79.1 billion, $2 billion above forecast due to higher than expected corporate and income tax and GST revenue, reflecting the economy growing well. Net core Crown debt is forecast is 33.9% of GDP, $2.6 billion less than forecast. Mr Goldsmith, I'm not taking advice on numbers from you. While the government's books are in better shape than expected, we cannot afford to be complacent. We're still facing elevated levels of debt and OBGAL deficits for some years to come in response to the pandemic.
Supplementary. What other reports has he seen on the economy?
Mr Speaker, securing the recovery is also being supported by industries including the export sector. Statistics New Zealand reported yesterday that the terms of trade for the March quarter 2021 remain near historical highs, rising 0.1%. Exports continue to be resilient, with global demand pushing up log prices while dairy and meat prices experience modest declines. BNZ economists noted that the result continues a period of relative buoyancy in the terms of trade, which has been a major support to the New Zealand economy. They anticipate terms of trade to rise further over coming quarters to a new record level as the likes of higher dairy prices filter into the official statistics.
Supplementary. What other reports has he seen about the impact of the agricultural sector on the economy?
Speaker, Fonterra is forecasting a record high milk price payout forecast range for the coming season. The cooperative announced an opening forecast for the 21-22 season, which started at the beginning of June, of between $7.25 per kilo of milk solids to $8.75 per kilo, with a midpoint of $8 per kilo. It is its previous highest ever opening price was $7 per kilo. Fonterra cited an improving global economy and strong demand for dairy amid muted growth in global supply. The midpoint of the forecast would see the cooperative contributing more than $12 billion to the economy next season, which is indeed very good news, and we thank the sector for its contribution.
Question number three, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Well, thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Public Service. What is the estimated average increase in public sector pay, excluding step-based progressions, built into the estimates of appropriations for Budget 2021?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr Speaker, I'm advised that the estimates of appropriations do not build in any average increases in the public sector, so the level of detail around public sector pay sought by the member is not available in those documents. As was the case under previous governments, staff pay increases beyond the budgeted year are managed within baselines, except where there is a specific budget initiative that's been approved to provide additional funding to particular organisations for that purpose.
To the Minister, is the appropriation in Vote Health for DHB cost pressures, $1.2 billion less than last year's increase, in part because of the government's expectations for low or no pay increases in that sector?
No.
How much of the $90 million reduction in Vote Police is a consequence of an expectation for lower wage growth for the 12,000 staff who work for New Zealand Police?
Mr Speaker, the government doesn't reveal in the budget appropriation documents the funding that is set aside for potential pay increases.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
How would the Minister describe a negotiating strategy for pay that revealed the amount of money available for that pay?
Well, Mr Speaker, it wouldn't be very much of a strategy at all. In fact, it's likely to result in the money being made available through the budget documents for pay being insufficient to meet the demands that it would likely generate.
But to the Minister, is paragraph 2.2 of the Public Service Pay Guidance released by the Public Service Commission, which says, quote, "The default position is that there are to be no increases to bands for lower and to middle income earners' pay, an example of a negotiating strategy."
Mr Speaker, it's if the member reads the entirety of that guidance, he'll find it's a much more subtle position than the one adopted by the previous national government of which he was a part, that basically said no one was allowed pay increases at all.
To the Minister. Would paragraph 4, which says, quote, universal across-the-board pay increases are not consistent with this guidance, be an example of his definition of subtle?
Mr. Speaker, the member needs to read the entirety of the guidance.
Was the government forced to act to control salary cost increases in this budget, in part because it now realises the structural cost impacts of the more than 10,000 extra public servants it has recruited since 2017?
Mr. Speaker, can I thank the member for his question and the opportunity to remind the House of the people that we are talking about here, which includes the 1,000 extra people employed by MSD to, among other things, provide the wage subsidy that kept hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders in work, the 434 people recruited by the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment who are protecting our border from COVID-19. The 328 extra people employed by the Ministry of Primary Industries to deal with, among other things, Mycoplasma bovis, critical to our primary industries. 609 additional people employed by Oranga Tamariki, who are mostly social workers dealing with our most vulnerable. Order. I could continue on, Mr. Order, Speaker, order.
No,
if you'd like me
no,
to.
No, the member can't continue on. He's not going to list out the entire 10,000.
Mike Waterhouse?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. No more subs. No, OK. Kieran McAnulty.
To the Minister, were there any others on that list?
Indeed, Mr. Speaker.
Oh. Right. That question has been answered.
Question number 4, Angela Roberts.
Te lofa lava, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Education. What steps is the government taking to address historical imbalances in funding for vocational education and training?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, between 2014 and 2019, the average amount of government tuition funding per learner for vocational education and training increased by significantly less than the consumer price index. In other words, it went backwards in real terms. It increased by 2.4%, which is significantly less than the average rate increase for degree level education, which was 11.4% over that period of time. That's why in this year's budget we've invested an additional $279.5 million over the next 4 years to bring vocational education and training funding up so that it is sustainable and so that we can boost that part of our education system.
Supplementary, why has the government considered it important to provide this rebalancing now?
Mr. Speaker, vocational education and training has long been undervalued in our education system. In fact, and those areas are covered by this funding, we're often talking about the areas of skill shortages that are the most acute here in New Zealand, making sure that we make the economics of those programs stack up and recruit more people into those training areas will go a long way to helping New Zealand rebuild from COVID-19 by tackling the critical skill shortages that have been holding us back.
Supplementary. How will the increased funding in 2022 support apprentices and other workers learning in the workplace?
Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased to say that funding rates for apprentices and those in industry training will increase by 5%. That will start to align those funding rates better, the work integrated learning funding rates, with provider based learning funding rates as we move to a more unified funding system for all vocational education and training.
Question number 5, Brooke Penfelton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and reads as follows. Does he stand by his statement, quote, I don't buy into extremist rhetoric, end quote, in relation to comments from Patient Voice Aotearoa on pharmac funding? And if so,
order,
what did
order,
he...
Order, 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 order. Question finished. The Honourable Andrew Little.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I stand by the statement as quoted, but point out that the member is incorrect, that the statement, as it was presented to me at the time I was questioned about it, was from Patient Voice Aotearoa. The statement was, that, well, the comment I made, was in response to a quote from an individual.
Supplementary. Does he believe that advocating for increased funding for life-saving medicines is extremist?
Mr Speaker, no, and I think the member makes the mistake of assuming that a comment I make about one person's statement is a comment made about hundreds of other people. It simply is not.
Point of order.
A point of order, Brock Fenfeld.
The comment that the minister is making is in relation to a person who is advocating on behalf of Patient Voice Aotearoa, which is Patient Voice Aotearoa.
Yeah, and it's not the member's job to try and correct a minister's answer by way of point of order. I think the member, you know, while she's a relatively new member of the House, actually knows that one doesn't argue about answers by way of point of order. Brooke Van Velden.
Supplementary. Will he apologise to the individual in question for describing their advocacy for increased funding for medicines as extremist rhetoric?
Mr Speaker, I will not criticise anybody who challenges, contests, opposes, protests about any measure by government, but I will take a stance on people who use extreme language.
Dr Shane Reddy.
What was the quote from the individual that he has deemed to be extremist rhetoric?
Mr Speaker, that's an interesting question. I don't quite recall it, except at the time I made a judgment that it was extreme, and it's interesting how much coverage has been given to my response and not the quote that was put to me.
Question number six, Rachel Brocking.
Talofalava, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Environment. What changes is the government making to the resource management system?
The government is repealing and replacing the Resource Management Act during this parliamentary term, primarily with two acts. The Strategic Planning Act, the SPA, will integrate the other legislation relevant to development and require long-term regional spatial strategies. The Act will integrate functions under the RMA, the Local Government Act, the Land Transport Management Act and the Climate Change Response Act to enable clearer and more efficient decision-making and private sector investment. The Natural and Built Environments Act, the NBA, will provide for land use and environmental regulation. An exposure draft of the core parts of that bill is due to be sent to the Environment Committee in the coming weeks.
Supplementary. Why is the government repealing and replacing the Resource Management Act?
Mr Speaker, urban areas have been struggling to keep pace with population growth and the need for affordable housing. Water quality has deteriorated, biodiversity is diminishing, and there's an urgent need to reduce carbon emissions as well as adapt to climate change. The new laws will improve the natural environment, better enable development within environmental limits, provide an effective role for Maori while improving housing supply and process affordability. This will be achieved through planning processes that will be improved so that costs and times are reduced for users of the system.
How did Budget 2021 support the reform of the resource management system?
Mr Speaker, the government's investing $131.8 million in the design, enactment and transition, which includes a substantial progress to be made on implementation of the reforms through to 2024. In my view, the success of the new system and its ability to hit the ground running doesn't depend just on the new legislation, but on proper implementation. The government's commitment to properly funding the transition is really born of a lesson of why the RMA, which is essentially quite good legislation, did not perform as was intended. After the 91 Act was passed, the Environment Court wasn't properly funded. Plans and consents were held up for many years, which held up a lot of development. There were no standard forms of plans, no standard formats. There was very little national direction, so there was too much uncertainty. National policy such as freshwater or urban development guidance was too little, too late. And we're not going to make that same mistake. We intend to redraft the National Planning Framework to produce draft NBA and SPA plans and related maps as part of the transitional program so that this hits the ground running once the legislation comes into effect.
The Honourable Scott Simpson.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister, why, when house price inflation continues unabated at about 20% a year, is he not moving faster on his resource management system reforms?
The member's wrong. I think the latest house price inflation in Auckland central suburbs was a decrease of 1% in the central city and 2% in Devonport, and both the Treasury and the Reserve Bank are predicting Treasury and the inflation in the coming year of 1% or 2% per annum averaged across the country.
Question number 7, Ricardo Menendez-March.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, does she stand by her statement, quote, "I'm not going to pretend that living on $315 is easy," end quote? If so, what further steps is she going to take to ensure everybody can live with dignity?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Tāna whālua, Mr. Speaker. Yes, living on $315 per week isn't easy. From the 1st of April, this will be the main benefit rate for a single person 25 years or over without children. And depending on their circumstances, they may be eligible for supplementary assistance like the accommodation supplement. We've come a long way, but we have more to do when it comes to welfare reform and making sure everybody can live with dignity. That is why the government announced a review of Working for Families in Budget 2020-21. This review was proposed by the Welfare Expert Advisory Group and is one of a number of recommendations we are working through in the short, medium and long term. However, I'd also like to point out that most people on a benefit want to work. Budget 2021 sees the government invest a further $99 million in work-focused case management. This investment, along with increasing main benefit rates, will help us achieve our aim of ensuring people can live with dignity.
Commentary. What steps is she taking, if any, so that people don't miss out on temporary additional support payments due to increases to core benefits?
Mr. Speaker, there is a misconception that people will have their temporary additional support abated dollar for dollar with benefit increases. That's not the case. Mr. Speaker, there are many interactions within the welfare system. One of them with regards to temporary additional support is also the temporary disability exception, which is on top of temporary additional support if people have a disability and have more expenses. There's an interaction there, Mr. Speaker, that could have seen people worse off. MSD has fixed that. There will be about 120 people on the 1st of July who may be worse off because of the benefit changes and the interactions, but a temporary additional payment will be put in place so that doesn't happen.
Supplementary. Does she agree that the reason some people experience an overall decrease when there are benefit increases is because the welfare system is broken, overly complicated, and ineffective at helping our most vulnerable?
I would agree that it is overly complicated, and that is part of the set of recommendations that came from the Welfare Expert Advisory Group, recommendations that were about making the welfare system less complex so that we don't have interactions that result in people being worse off in any way. And so we continue to look at the welfare system and how we can fix that and make it less complicated.
Supplementary. What further recommendations from the 2-year-old Welfare Expert Advisory Group is she planning to fully implement this year?
Mr. Speaker, as I said, the government has committed to undertaking a review of Working for Families. There's a number of other things going on. There's work on how we address debt across government for people who have debt to government. There is work going on with regards to childcare assistance and what we should do with that moving forward. Mr. Speaker, we're constantly looking at the Welfare Expert Advisory Group's report and seeing how we can do things better. I don't want to preempt any other changes at the moment, but we will definitely see more.
Supplementary. Is she aware that if JobSeeker had been put at $315 and indexed to wages in 2019 as recommended by the Welfare Expert Advisory Group, the value of JobSeeker would be at least $335 a week today, and it is therefore inaccurate to say that the increases honour the report?
Mr. Speaker, When we received that report, we said that we would not be able to address every recommendation in that report immediately. We laid out a short, medium, long-term plan. I think many of us in this House are relieved that we've been able to increase benefits to the extent that we have. And yes, we did meet the Welfare Expert Advisory Group's recommendations, but actually we also need to keep in mind here that for beneficiaries with children, we went beyond what the Welfare Expert Advisory Group had recommended.
Supplementary. Will she consider universalising working for families so that people outside of paid employment are supported by the payment?
Mr. Speaker, as I said, there is a review of working for families that will be undertaken this year, and I don't want to preempt any decisions that will be made as part of that.
Jan Logie.
Thank you. Will further increases to baseline benefits be needed to lift the 130,000 children who continue to live in material hardship out of poverty?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's important to keep in mind that a large number of children living in material hardship are actually in working households. And I think today Brian Perry and MSD presented a report that showed about, I think, 50% of those are in working households. I think it's important to keep in mind that there are a number of reasons why they experience material hardship. The additional costs in relation to disability is one. Another is debt and having to service that debt. So there's a range of work that needs to go on. It's not all about increasing benefits. There's some other areas that we need to address as well.
Question number 8, Matt Tusi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, what proportion of the mental health funding announced in Budget 2019 that was supposed to be spent by year two has been spent? And what measurable difference, if any, has this made to the mental health of New Zealanders?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, as the member is aware, $1.9 billion was announced in Budget 2019. $1.1 billion of that was made available for Vote Health. And so my answer will be confined to the Vote Health part of it. To answer the first part of the member's question, of the $1.1 billion, around $350 million was made available to be spent by the end of year two, that is the 30th of June this year. And as at mid-May this year, roughly $290 million has been committed in contract. That is because the nature of the contracts is they are invoiced on a monthly sort of basis, so we won't know till roughly August what has been fully spent to the 30th of June. To answer the second part of the member's question, if we turn to the flagship Integrated Primary Mental Health and Addiction Services part of the package, I can tell him that that service is now available in over 195 sites across 16 district health boards. It covers an enrolled patient population of about 1.4 million people. More than 360 full-time equivalent roles have been added to GP and community clinics to provide those services, alongside 70 full-time equivalent roles in other access and choice services. Over 119,000 sessions have been delivered, with around 10,000 people now being seen per month. Mr. Speaker, in addition to that, we've established the Pregnancy and Parenting Service in Eastern Bay of Plenty and Whanganui. We've established new alcohol and other drug support services and family and whānau peer support services in Taranaki. We've funded 8 additional clinical psychology internships each year. We've topped up the Rainbow Wellington Wellbeing Legacy Fund, and we've put in place 16 youth services across 15 DHB areas with more than 60 contracted full-time equivalent roles and more sessions delivered. In addition to that, we've established the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, the Suicide Prevention Office. Mr. Speaker, I could go on.
Supplementary. So what is his response to mental health advocate Mike King, who said about the lack of improvement in mental health, quote, "There is more than enough money in the system, it's just the incompetence at the top," end quote.
I would say to Mr. King exactly what I said in my answer to the member's primary question.
Supplementary. So is Mike King wrong when he says things haven't changed in New Zealand's mental health sector? And if so, why?
Mr. Speaker, Mike King is a highly respected advocate for mental health, a champion for that cause, and he is entitled to his opinion. I disagree with him.
Supplementary. Is he embarrassed that as a result of his government's failure in mental health, Mike King has felt...
Order. The member will start that question again.
Is he embarrassed that as a result of the government's failure to deliver in mental health, Mike King has felt compelled to return the Order of Merit Medal he was awarded for his advocacy for mental health, and if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, regardless of what Mike King does in relation to the award made to him, the reasons for that award stand. He is a highly regarded, highly respected champion for the cause of improving the nation's mental health. He is a very fierce advocate for it, and I support him in every step he takes in that regard.
Supplementary. When Grant Robertson said he was having a conversation with the Health Minister about whether the $1.9 billion is being adequately spent, did he commit in that conversation to doing a better job?
Mr. Speaker, I have regular conversations with the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Finance repeatedly expresses confidence in what I do.
Question number nine, Rachel Boyack.
My question is to the Minister of Local Government. What recent reports has she seen about water infrastructure in New Zealand?
The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Mr. Speaker, I've seen reports released by the Department of Internal Affairs yesterday which provide New Zealanders with a clear picture of the urgent problems our water services and infrastructure face. The reports include analysis of the economic benefits of reform by the Water Industry Commission of Scotland, independent reviews of WICS methodology by Farrisware and Becker, and an analysis of the effects of the proposed reform on the economy and affected industries by Deloitte. Together, the reports confirm the need for major reform to upgrade and maintain our water infrastructure, protect our environment and avoid unaffordable increases to household bills. They identify investment of between $120 billion and $185 billion is needed over 30 years to ensure New Zealanders' drinking, waste and stormwater infrastructure meets acceptable public health and environmental standards. The reports also highlight the economic benefits we can unlock by tackling these challenges, such as job creation, an increase in GDP and tax revenue.
What do these reports say about the affordability of three water services into the future?
Mr. Speaker, without reform, average household bills in 2051 are forecast to range from $13,900 a year. This is simply unaffordable for many communities. For example, in Auckland, it's been recently reported that water bills could double in less than a decade. Central and local government accept that the current arrangement of 67 council water providers is not working. The government is proposing a small number of large publicly owned water service providers. Under reform proposals with 3 to 5 providers, those figures would be much less, ranging from 800 to 1,800 a year. The modelling underpinning the reports is based on data provided by every council. I'd like to acknowledge their hard work and expertise of council staff that helped us put together this data.
What do these reports tell us about the potential impact reforming New Zealand's water services could have on our economy?
Thank you for the question. The Deloitte Economic Impact Report finds that every region in New Zealand is expected to be positively impacted through the reform, with provincial and rural areas estimated to benefit most. Benefits include an increase in GDP of between $14 billion to $23 billion in current dollar terms over 30 years, an additional 5,800 to 9,300 FTE jobs across all sectors. The water sector workforce is forecast to increase by 80%, an increase in average wages associated with improved productivity and more high-skilled jobs in the economy, and additional tax receipts of about between $4 billion and $6 billion.
What other challenges are the reforms proposing to address?
I believe that all communities should benefit from this reform. Every New Zealander, irrespective of where they live, should be able to drink water safely from the tap. It is unacceptable to have sewer pipes bursting on city streets and sewage seeping into our waterways. It's intolerable that there are communities like Te Kau in New Zealand that do not have potable water supplies and that they're still on a regular boiled water notice. That's why the government is working to address the challenges facing these critical services and the communities that currently fund and use them.
Question number 10, Dr. James Rickdale.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Immigration. Does he stand by all policy decisions made in relation to the new accredited employer work visa? If so, is he confident that the new visa will improve the immigration system?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr. Speaker, Whawhatau Lover. The new accredited employer work visa was developed in consultation with business, workers and migrants themselves. When we announced the changes back in 2019, we set out our intent to rebalance our temporary work visa system. This is by ensuring that businesses are able to get the workers they need to fill critical work skill shortages, but also encouraging employers and regions to work together on long-term workforce planning, including supporting New Zealanders with the training they need to fill the gaps. The new accredited employer work visa does this by replacing six visa categories with one temporary work visa, and it ensures there is an employer check, a job check and a worker check. This makes it far more streamlined and supports this government's overall objective to lay better foundations for the future through a rebalanced immigration system. So in answer to the question, yes and yes.
Supplementary. Is the Minister confident that Immigration New Zealand will be able to avoid creating a significant backlog of employer accreditation applications?
Mr. Speaker, yes. The new system comes into force on the 1st of November and we are allowing accreditation to begin earlier than that.
Certain that the new scheme will not increase migrant exploitation if, for example, bad employers demand money from migrants in exchange for supporting their visa applications?
Mr. Speaker, I'm very glad that question has been asked because the new system will prevent migrant exploitation happening compared to the old regime. Under the new regime, there will be an employer check, and one of the gates that you will have to pass for that is being a good employer, and that is being compliant with the employment and immigration law. I'm surprised that the ACT Party, who support and advocate for business and people following the law, aren't supporting the new system which makes sure that good employers are compliant with the law and therefore, because of that, there will be less exploitation.
Erica Stanford.
On what date will the Minister produce a complete set of instructions so all users have 100% clarity on cost and how long it will take for businesses to go through the accreditation process, given they all have to be accredited by the 1st of November?
Mr. Speaker, I can't give a precise date. But in answer to the member's question, well before the new system comes into force.
Is the Minister concerned that a potential backlog of employer accreditation applications could lead to greater migrant exploitation as workers will be less able to change employers because many will still be waiting for their accreditation?
Mr. Speaker, as I said in a previous answer, the potential for this new system is to drastically reduce the amount of migrant exploitation that has been in the system historically. And again, the ability for businesses to become accredited is going to open well before the system comes into force.
Question number 11, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. Will Budget 2021 help reduce gang membership and violence? If so, how?
The Honourable Porto
Williams. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, this government inherited annual police funding of $1.5 billion in 2017. We've increased that to over $2 billion, an increase of roughly 30%.
Order. Do the members want to have an answer to this in the supplementaries? Well, there's at least three members there almost preventing it. Potter Williams.
Budget 2021 continues funding for the Striving Towards 1800 New Police program, including 700 police to be focused on organised crime, as well as increasing funding for preventing family and sexual violence, continuing action to improve social inclusion, and an expansion to Te Pai Oranga iwi community panels, which have shown a reduction in harm from reoffending by 22% by participants.
How will the $90 million cut to the police budget in Budget 2021 2021 help reduce the record number of people joining gangs under this government?
Mr Speaker, I reject the premise of that question. The police budget is 30% higher than it was when National left office. I stand by statements that I have made around that there is no decrease in budget, as the member claims. And they are a result of ongoing negotiations for road policing funding, which is around $63 million. Expect news on this shortly, and one-off funding such as the Whanganui Police Hub shovel-ready project.
How will the police finish recruiting the promised 700 police officers dedicated to combating gangs and organised crime, given the police budget has been cut by $90 million?
Mr Speaker, I repeat, the budget has not been cut by $90 million. The police are in negotiations with regards to costs for road policing. That announcement will be made shortly. There was approximately $25 million, which was a one-off for the Whanganui Police Hub shovel-ready project. There was an amount of $4.5 million, which the members claim was cut from the budget, but this is actually funding for reimbursements for police from the proceeds of Crime Fund, not the budget, and $5.5 million from primary response, which was funding for COVID-19 procurement of PPE and a cancellation of annual leave, which is no longer required.
Why has no new funding been given to the Gang Intelligence Centre in Budget 2021 when there has been a 50% increase in gang membership under this government?
Mr Speaker, I've clearly explained that, and I find it quite ironic, Mr Speaker, that since we've come to government, we've increased the police budget by 30%. And I stand by this government's record on this. That National Party, when they were in government, froze the budget and they cut police numbers. I stand on our record every day. I do not stand on theirs.
Point of order.
Point of order, Simeon Brown.
The question was around funding for the Gang Intelligence Centre in light of the increase in gang membership. That wasn't... Well, I mean, that's a interesting comment, but the point was around...
Who made the comment? Member will stand, withdraw and apologise.
I apologise.
Mr Brown will have two additional supplementaries. So one, you can use one of them to try that question again.
So the question was, why has no new funding been given to the Gang Intelligence Centre in Budget 2021, given the 50% increase in gang membership under this government?
Mr Speaker, I want to just refer to an operation that's live at the moment, Operation Tofiro, in terms of the police response to gangs. And this has seized 522 firearms, seized $2.6 million in cash, arrested 476 people, seized methamphetamine and conducted 361 search warrants. The police are doing a fantastic job at dealing with gangs, and I stand on that record.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
Point of order, Senator Brown.
The question was around the Gang Intelligence Centre.
No, I think it's fair to say the general question on the relationship between funding and gangs and police response was addressed. Simeon Brown, further supplementary.
Does the Gang Intelligence Centre not need any additional funding given the 50% increase in gang membership?
I'm going to just sort of remind the member just to keep his questions to questions without the additional comments afterwards. Potter Williams.
Mr Speaker, I reject the premise of that question.
How will the $90 million cut to the police budget boost officer morale given the record increase in gang violence in New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, I've already addressed that question.
Member's still got another one.
Okay, thank you. Supplementary. When will the police complete recruitment of the promised 700 police officers dedicated to combat gangs and organised crime?
As I've said repeatedly in this House, we are on target to meeting the 2023 target, as stated in this House repeatedly over and over and over again.
Question number 12, Willow Jean Prime.
Talo Falava, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Acting Minister for Emergency Management and asks, how does Budget 2021 help ensure our emergency management systems are geared towards an inclusive, community-led response to natural disasters and health events?
Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Talo Falava, Mr Speaker. Budget 2021 provided a $46.6 million funding boost for the National Emergency Management Agency to strengthen our emergency management system and make our communities safer and more resilient to natural disasters and other emergencies. As demonstrated earlier this week, these emergencies can impact anyone, anywhere at any time, and this is an investment that will benefit every New Zealander. This initiative realises the Government's manifesto commitments to ensure our emergency management systems are geared towards an exclusive community-led response to emergency and events, and can I acknowledge Minister Kitty Allen, whose strong advocacy for the Emergency Management Corps secured the funding in this year's budget.
Supplementary, how will this funding help communities?
Tanafa, Mr Speaker. Well, strong communities need a responsive and inclusive emergency management system that is up to the task and empowers them in times of crisis. As an example, we've seen time and time again how iwi have sprung into action to support communities impacted by disasters, and this funding will enable meaningful partnership with iwi Māori in our emergency management system. This funding will increase opportunities for critical important work in the emergency management sector to keep our communities safe.
Supplementary. What will this funding deliver?
Tala Falava, Mr Speaker. The funding boost will lift the performance of the emergency management system at the local, national and regional level and empower communities before, during and after emergencies. The improvements that this funding will enable is growing the role of iwi Māori in emergency management and integrating iwi and Māori perspectives and tikanga into responses, a stronger, more professionalised emergency management workforce, greater coordination and planning across agencies involved in preparing and responding to emergencies, and targeted initiatives to support disproportionately affected communities, and improved hazard risk management expertise. This is a great investment to keep our community safe, and with that, I wish everyone a very safe Queen's Birthday weekend.
That concludes our... supplementary question, the Honourable Jerry Brown.
Thank you. To the Minister, why has the recent natural disaster in Canterbury only been classified as a moderate event?
Well, Mr Speaker, I think that is a question for the Minister of Primary Industries in terms of the funding, or the $500,000 funding that he announced on Tuesday, I believe. In terms of my role as Acting Minister of Emergency Management, an initial contribution of $100,000 have been made to the emergency response. As the member will know, the assessment of the damage is still continuing in the region, and as that comes to further light, the government will surely respond to any requests that come from the region.
That concludes our questions.